Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, how are you, Diane?
I am well. How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
Yeah, you had a week, huh?
It was a week.
Yeah, so I understand.
It doesn't relate to cycling, so we're not going to talk about it.
All righty then. We're moving right along. So looks like we're getting some fall weather finally.
Yes, we are.
Good time of year to ride.
I love it.
Yeah, so fall also brings our trade show season, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the first of the shows was Eurobike. It ended on September 1st, last week. Many of the hottest products reported by the cycling website road.cc were in the accessory and apparel categories. So a couple of the ones that stood out for me were a camo shoe from Giro. Yeah, right. With like orange shoelaces. Very strange. But there was a cool one that you would like, an LED dynamo powered headlamp from the British company Exposure Lights.
Mm-hmm.
It was very cool. It was lightweight. And it had a great big head to it, and they also had a new hub. So it's a lighting system. But I've never heard of the company, Exposure Lights. I'm wondering if they'll be at Interbike. We'll see.
Okay.
There was a 50-gram water-repellent jacket.
Wow.
I know. Lightweight. You know, it's got to be lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for the weight weenies, we call those. So we'll see how many of those guys actually show up in Vegas. There is something about a lot of the Americans go to Eurobike, but not always all these Europeans come to Interbike. So we'll see.
A Eurobike, largest bicycle trade show in the world, bigger than Interbike.
Well, that's recent. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think they're going to try to expand Interbike when we move it in 2013 to Mandalay Bay.
Hmm.
We'll see. Anyway, it makes it impossible. Regardless of whether your bike's bigger than Interbike, it makes it impossible to see everything at Interbike. It is so big and so crowded. You always miss something. Anyway, I'll leave on the 17th, and I'm also happy to report that my new blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, should be up and running while I'm in Vegas, so you'll be able to follow some of that. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a show, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think we should get our show rolling because this is a good one. Our first guest is a champion cyclist. In fact, she's often referred to as the winningest cyclist in the U.S. She is now retired from racing. Karen Bliss was an explosive sprinter, a track rider, a road rider. And here is what was said about her in the notes from the Lehigh Valley Cycling Center when she was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2003. Karen Bliss was that rare talent that comes along once in a generation. She entered the world of cycling at a relatively late age. A dedicated sports nut through her scholastic years in Quakertown, Karen found cycling at Penn State University and quickly excelled at the sport. She was the first local woman to earn the role of star and won a U.S. national points race title in her first full season on the track. She ended her career as a road rider, but she endeared herself to the people of T-Town, Trexlertown, early with her riding and her intelligent, articulate conversations. And true to that nature, when Karen retired from cycling, she stayed in our industry and has become the marketing director of ASI, which is the parent company of several brands, including Fuji. It is my privilege to be able to speak with her this evening. Then we're going to head out to Seattle to talk with a man who is arguably one of, if not the best storyteller writing and speaking in the bike world today. No, hard feelings about Maynard, but this guy's pretty funny. Willie Weir grew up in Sacramento, California, comes from a background in theater. He's traveled by bike to many, many, many wonderful places and tells his stories in person in guest appearances, as well as in two books and a series of monthly columns and blog entries for Adventure Cyclist magazine. He's engaging, he's fun, and we'll talk with Willie in the second half of the show. If we have time, we'll throw in some news, but I'm anxious to talk with Karen, so let's welcome her to the show. Good evening, Karen. Thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to learn a little bit more about you and your background before we talk about your cycling career and your transition to what you're doing now. Where did you come from And when did you first become interested in cycling?
Wow, I went to college at Penn State and decided to join the cycling team there, having no experience in bike racing and not really understanding or knowing what it was all about. But for me, you know, I'd ridden my bike to swim practice in the morning. The bike was a key part of my growing up, and I thought, you know, this is a way for me to make friends in a really giant place as a, you know, an 18-year-old, and that's how I got my start, basically.
When you started out in the sport, did you find it sorely lacking for women?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the group rides that we started just, you know, back at Penn State, for every, I'd say, 20 men, there was one woman on these rides. And, you know, basically there were 40 men and two women on this ride. So, yes. And then in the sport itself, certainly, I mean, you know, that was true, when was that, like 20 years ago, as much as it is today. Even it's, you know, women's sports, certainly the cyclists have gotten better, but the sport itself is definitely still lacking.
Yeah, and we are going to talk about that, because I know you have a lot to say about that, and I think it's interesting. So during your racing career, which spanned, what, 15 years?
Yep, 15 years.
Who sponsored you mainly? Because women's sponsorship has always been a big problem.
You know, when you're an amateur and you're sort of just, you know, making your way through the ranks, you're just lucky to get whatever you can get. So I had, you know, like my uncle and, you know, friends of friends give me money and, you know, buy me parts and things like that. But when I eventually got on a bigger team, it was Saturn, sponsored by Saturn Cars. But that was the most successful sponsorship for a women's team in the U.S. at that time. And honestly, the reason being is because it was attached to a men's team. So as sad as that is to admit, it was Saturn saw the value in sponsoring a cycling team. They pulled it into all their marketing, but having just the women alone was not going to be enough for them. But they were sort of kind enough, if you will, to include the women in their marketing efforts.
Do you think women's bike racing is not as exciting as men's bike racing, or is it just not as well known?
I've gotten that question so many times, and certainly when I was racing, you know, people ridiculed women's cycling because the speeds were slower, there weren't as many people, and so, you know, the tactics were limited, and all the exciting things about the men's sport you couldn't really see play out in the women's sport because of the money that was there. Not many women are attracted to the sport. Because of that, there are fewer women who race. You know, in my position now, which I know we're going to get to later, as a marketing person, I get asked that question all the time. So if you sponsor a women's team, how do you connect that to sales of bikes to women? It's a stretch. So to answer your original question, it isn't as exciting. You know, it's exciting in its own way, but it, you know, people are trained to look at bike racing in a certain way. Like, you watch the Tour de France and you understand the Alpe d'Huez and, you know, the teamwork. Women's teams are smaller. Women's, you know, we ride slower as much as we don't want to. I mean, it's just a biological fact at this point anyway. You know, and I hate to bring it down like that because it is exciting. And I've had so much joy and excitement from racing that I don't want to, you know, discourage any woman from getting involved. But from a spectator's point of view, I think men's racing is still a little bit more exciting.
Well, let me ask a different question, one that didn't occur to me until now, and that is women's racing a clean sport?
Yes, I definitely believe it is. I mean, certainly there's going to be the cheaters, right? So I'm not saying it's 100% clean, but, you know, all this stuff with Lance Armstrong and, you know, the bottom line on that, it's just systemic. I mean, the men's sport, there's so much money involved that, you know, and like many other professional sports, you know, people, it's just the way of the peloton. You know, it's in there and it happens. And, you know, not to think that things aren't getting cleaned up, because they are, but they will never be super clean because of all the money at stake and what drugs do to enhance performance. You know, it's a debatable thing for sure. But anyway, in the women's side of the sport, because there's not as much money, because there's not as much exposure, you know, women are not driven to go to those lengths. It's not systemic. You know, I once had a coach who said that the men in the sport do drugs, the women use food. And by that he meant, you know, there's certainly times when, you know, there's like a whole anorexic type approach
right.
to, if I can just get super skinny, then I'll be able to climb better and I'll be a superstar. And, you know, that was more of the issue. You know, in some levels it's still an issue at this point, but, yeah, drugs aren't a huge part of the women's peloton.
That's interesting, though, that there are other issues for women who mm-hmm. see themselves as not being competitive enough because they're either not thin enough or not strong or whatever it is. I guess it's the same in every sport, but it would be nice to see women's racing as exciting as men's, even if it's just in the eyes of, you know, the audience more than anything else.
Yeah, I totally agree. I know, because it is, I mean, when you're in there and you're racing, it's so exciting. I mean, there's just so much. You know, the mental part, the physical part, you know, cycling has so much to offer. I wouldn't have given up that 15 years for anything. It was really a great experience for me.
And that's what we're going to talk about now, your winningest cyclist in North America. And you have been referred to as that. Do you know how many races you actually won in your 15-year career?
I don't know the exact number, but, you know, I've done, you know, I've kept race journals or, you know, training in race journals
sure.
and, you know, sort of added up and came to the conclusion that I won over 300.
Wow. So, now
yeah.
you also participated in more than just one discipline. You were track.
Right.
And road. And
yep.
time trial?
Yeah, a little bit. Time trial was
yeah.
in there. Yep. Yep.
So what do you think are your top two or three most proud achievements in those 15 years? What would you categorize as your top achievements, the things you're most proud of about your career?
I think, honestly, my takeaway when, you know, I'm now almost 15 years removed from the sport, I look back on it, and the thing I'm most proud of is having worked with a team and having, you know, just dedicated myself to something that I was passionate about and that I was good at, and getting that feeling, you know, the feeling that I got from being involved in the sport was, I can't even... You know, I try to compare it to things in my work life now, and there's just nothing like it. So I, honestly, I'm so proud of the fact that I got to be able to experience that. It sounds sort of, you know, it's not real clear, but it's,
No, I think that's clear.
Yeah.
That's clear. You know, you got to be a great cyclist. I mean, what could be cooler than that? It'd be like being a great anything, you know?
Exactly.
So
yeah.
You gave an interview to Julie Walsh of Bicycling about sprinting. And, you know, a lot of people, I think... We, you know, when we do bike fittings and we're going, oh, you're small, you're probably going to be a good this, or, you know, you'll mm-hmm. be a good climber, or you're really big, you're going to be a good long distance endurance person. But you were thought of, or you are thought of, as an explosive sprinter. What do you think makes a great sprinter?
Definitely some genetics.
Okay.
you know, I've had great teammates that are, you know, the complete opposite of me in terms of, you know, I was never a great climber and, you know, I envy the fact that they could just, you know, dance up a mountain and, but you look at them and I'm like, how, you know, you try to get that same woman to, you know, have an explosive sprint and it's just not in her. So there's definitely a genetic factor, that I definitely will, thank my dad for, and he'll be happy to hear me say that.
Thanks, Dad.
Right. And I think, you know, training, because I knew that I was sort of predisposed to being a great sprinter, I really trained for it, too. You know, I'm like, this is what I have to offer to the sport, so I might as well be the best sprinter I can be. And, you know, I really did specific training around it.
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Karen Bliss, the winningest women cyclist in U.S. history. A 15-year career, she has transitioned into the business side of the bicycle industry, and we'll get to that in a moment. I want to talk about equipment for a second, though, if that's okay. When you started out, I assume you were racing a steel bike.
Yes, I was. Yep.
Okay. What do you think about all the new bikes today?
Well, I work for a bike company.
Yes, you do.
So I have a unique perspective on this. You know, we still continue to make very good race bikes in steel, aluminum, and now carbon fiber is the latest, greatest. During my career, I raced on steel and aluminum and not carbon fiber. You know, that sort of came after my career. And now that I have access to these bikes and I've been able to ride on carbon fiber, it's amazing.
Okay.
It's really, really different. It's, you know, with carbon, it's a material and So you can create it and mold it so to give you different ride characteristics. So if I want a bike that's a pure sprint bike, I can make, you know, the bottom bracket area very stiff or the head tube very stiff. You can't do that with aluminum or steel. So my first experience riding carbon fiber, I remember I got on, I set it all up, and I went out, and I first, like, push on the pedal. It was like riding a rocket ship. I mean, it was that responsive. It was really utterly amazing. But that said, you know, I still have my old steel bike, and I love the way it rides. I mean, there's just something so beautiful about it, just really comfortable and nice. So, you know, it, carbon fiber for racing, I would definitely push that, and that's what everybody wants these days. But aluminum is still very quality, and steel is still viable.
Well, I think the equipment has gotten better. Obviously, the components have just gotten incredibly good. Have you tried any of the electronic shifting?
I have, and yes, I get it. I especially appreciate it for a time trial type event where you can't really, you don't want to come out of your position to, you know, make a shift or
right.
That kind of, you know, instant, you want instant sort of response. I'm still a fan of mechanical for road racing, though. I don't know. There's just something really positive about it. Not that, you know, I mean, electronic is fine. But the biggest, I mean, you know, taking a step back, the biggest innovation for me was when I was racing during the shift from down tube shifters to shifters in your brake lever.
Right.
And that, to me, was huge because, you know, as a sprinter, you want to get into that gear, the final gear that you're going to sprint in, as smoothly and easily as possible. And sometimes you don't do that. Sometimes you're in the middle of the sprint and you're like, oh, shoot, you know, I need this other gear. Do I have to take my hand off my bars, pull it all the way down to the down tube, make the shift? No way. I lost the race right there. So
right.
That, to me, was the biggest innovation.
That and clipless pedals, you know.
Oh, yes.
Just that ability
exactly
to
right.
get in those pedals and spin circles.
Yep.
So let's move to something you and I probably, I'm not sure if we have the same point on this or not. Do you think women's specific is a category that's necessary, or is it really marketing, marketing lady?
Well, I like the way you posed the question when you sent it to me, which is person specific. And
okay, good.
I believe that, you know, I came in from the sport, you know, having, there were no women's specific bikes when I was racing, race bikes anyway. And, you know, so I'm like, you know, come on, I did it. I can ride on a regular men's type bike, whatever. Everybody can do it. There's no big deal. But I think where I was sort of coming from was I'm an average size. I'm 5'7". I'm not like, I don't have any super long legs or anything that's going to make me not fit onto a regular bike. But when you, you know, a lot of my teammates and a lot of women today, I mean, we're people, right? I mean, there's some really short bike racers and there's some really tall bike racers.
Right.
And I think for me, the women's category is viable. I think, you know, we make a women's specific bike now. Fuji makes a women's specific bike that our top teams race on, carbon fiber. And across the board, the women love it, you know, and they're all different shapes and sizes. So a little bit shorter top tube, you know, a little bit closer reach for the brakes, things like that to accommodate the little differences between an average female and an average male. They make a difference. They make a difference. So, you know, I do believe in the women's specific bike, but not to the extent that all women like this, all men like, you know, that's just sort of silly. So,
okay.
You know.
Let's talk about advice you might give to a young woman who'd like to start racing a bicycle. Where do you think that would start? Would that start in high school or would that start in college? I know the collegiate racing circuit is getting bigger, actually.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend. I mean, certainly, you know, how women get in, it's an obscure sport still. So how women get involved, it's normally through, you know, a relative or a boyfriend or a husband or, you know, a friend, whatever. But I think if you're sort of on your own and you're hearing this conversation, you think, bike racing is for me. That's my sport. I can feel it. I think the thing to do is to find out if there's clubs in your area, and it's easy to find a bike shop and just say, hey, look, you know, I'm looking for a club, you know, because from a club, you're going to be in contact with people who have all different interest in cycling, but a lot of them are in racing. And that's honestly the best way to go to a bike shop, ask, you know, they may send you to another bike shop, but it's a start. I think that's the best way to get going because you want to find people like you. You
right.
know, they're the ones that are going to help you.
Yeah, I think that is very good advice. Very, very good advice. When you retired from racing, you did decide to stay with the industry, which I can appreciate because the brain drain, you know, happens in a lot of industries. But it's nice to have somebody with, you know, the experience and the background that you have in bicycling to stay. So you've stayed pretty much with one of your original sponsors, Fuji, which
yeah.
is kind of cool. So does your work with them help bring more equality, do you think, to women cyclists at all? Are you working toward that? Because I know you laid out a plan for improving the state of women's cycling for the UCI. And I don't know if there was ever any response for that, but you absolutely have some very strong ideas about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think single-handedly I'm going to help, you know, elevate the sport by any means. But I think it's, you know, good to draw attention to it. You know, and my challenge was to the UCI. The UCI is the governing body of, you know, worldwide the sport of cycling. And they did respond. They, you know, I got some personal emails and some conversations. And my proposition is that as an industry, you know, we need to grow. I mean, the bicycle sales, at least sales of bicycles, has remained pretty flat over the past, you know, 10 years, 20 years since the mountain bike boom sort of infused it with more sales. But you know, we thought the transportation category would grow with the raising gas prices, but that has a little. But in general, it's, you know, it's remained sort of where it is. And, you know, for those of us in the industry, and we want to see our jobs continue, we want to see, you know, the bicycles continue. My challenge to the UCI was, you know, women, there are so few women represented in the sport. You know, this is a way, this is a clear target, an easy way for us to grow the industry, grow this by growing the sport. So, you know, I get it. You know, they've got so much on their plate. You know, and they are certainly focused on, you know, growing the sport as well. And they appreciated that comment and the strategy, but nothing really is happening, a concerted effort within the UCI to make that grow.
Are you part of the group called Equality for Women in Professional Cycling or something like that, the Professional Women Equality? And it's to do with, I think it has to do with equality of pay for racing.
I didn't know there was a group. I certainly know that, you know, some of the cyclists, the women cyclists today have, you know, been really loud and challenged that, but I didn't know there was an actual group. And I, you know, I think that's just one component, honestly,
okay.
of what's going to help make it grow. I don't know that that's the answer. I mean, just because you're racing bikes doesn't mean you deserve this amount of pay. I mean,
sponsors
come in because it's, you know, they get something out of it. So people, I mean, certainly as a bike company, we know exactly what we get out of it. We get, you know, sort of recognition as a credible product and that kind of thing. But somebody who's coming in outside the industry, you know, we have to make it appealing for them to want to come in and put their money into, you know, the women's end of the sport. And just paying people more, I don't know. That's only one small part of what we need to do to attract these outside sponsors.
Well, I think that's a very honest response. I like it. So the last thing I want to talk about is something that actually came across my screen right before we came to the studio, and that is Fuji sponsoring a new German team. Well, I don't know if the team is new, but it's a new sponsorship for Fuji. Can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, you know, this relates to our whole conversation when I got into the bicycle industry business side of the whole bike thing, coming from the sports side to the industry side. You know, I honestly didn't, you know, I'm young, whatever. I go in, I'm like, yeah, this will be a piece of cake. I know I bring all this great stuff to this company. They're going to appreciate everything I've got to offer them. And, you know, I get in, I'm like, I don't know anything about this. So I had to start learning business from scratch and understanding what drove the industry and how the sport did fit in and that kind of stuff. And part of that was understanding the men's side of the sport a little bit more because it is so big, and you know, it does attract a lot of big money sponsors, and honestly, how could we be a part of that, you know? So we got into the Pro Tour 4 years ago for the very first time. Fuji, you know, Fuji rode in the Tour de France for the very first and only time, actually, in 2010. And these are huge milestones for the brand. And then we sort of got out last year because of the whole brouhaha with the title sponsor, Geox. And in any case, our goal was to get back in because it really does raise the level of credibility for the Fuji brand. Like, if the pros are riding Fuji bikes, they must be great, you know?
Right.
That kind of thing. So, we just signed with this German Pro Continental team. They've been a team for a couple of years now. They're really growing, and we're really glad to be a part of it. Germany is a huge market for us, you know, targeted for growth in Europe. So our sales manager there was really ecstatic that we got this going, and, you know, he sees a in Europe, it's really a real direct connection between sponsorship of a pro team and sales, whereas in the U.S., maybe not so much. I mean, if a team gets into the Tour de France, yeah, you know, people in the U.S. recognize that, wow, Fuji's in the Tour de France, but that's really, you know, the extent of the association when it comes to the general population in the U.S. So, but in any case, we're very proud. We're very happy to be back in the Tour, the Pro Tour, and proud of ourselves.
Well, and I think pat yourself on the back. That's it's a big coup. Well, do you think, and this, I was going to wrap it up with that, but this occurred to me too when you said being back in the Pro Tour. We had two, maybe even three, really big, well-attended races, stage races in this country this year.
We did.
Do you think the United States is going to grow that finally in a positive way?
Yeah, it was so great to see these really big, well-funded, well-established and well-run races in the U.S. because, you know, there's so many people that want to see that. You know, we're never going to really be the Tour de France. We don't have that kind of, like, following here. But at the same time, there's so many people that want racing that on the pro level that they can, you know, get to without having to fly over to Europe. So, yeah, really, really cool. And, you know, we support them as much as we can because it's great for our sales in the U.S. It's great for the sport in the U.S.
Well, this has been just so much fun, and I hope to meet you in person when we're out at Interbike. I will come by the booth and shake your hand because, you know, there's nothing like a woman to woman in our business. We're few and far between.
It's so true. Yes, please do. Please do. I'm looking forward to meeting you as well.
It was really delightful. So I hope you have a great evening and have a safe trip out to Vegas.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us, Karen.
Great. Thank you very much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Karen Bliss joined us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
My hometown.
Your hometown,
that
yes, indeed.
Correct. I was born there.
Okay.
I was. We don't get many women racers. I really was excited to be able to talk to her. And actually, Fuji is one of the very original high-performance, high-quality bikes out of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were a Fuji dealer many, many, many years ago. My favorite Fuji ad was a silver Fuji Finest on top of a silver Rolls-Royce. Huh. It was awesome. It was a great ad.
I owned a Fuji road bike once upon a time.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a lugged 4130 chrome Molly, nothing fancy, but...
One of the touring series?
No, it wasn't really a touring bike. It was more of a sport bike.
Yeah.
It wasn't real high-end, but... you know, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yep.
That's all that matters.
Steel is real. They made their own tubing. It was called Fuji Veilite tubing.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to enjoy the heck out of this little break we're going to take here.
Okay.
And then we come back. You and I have some news to discuss.
We do.
And then an interview with a great storyteller.
Yes, we will.
Stay tuned for that right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home, where I belong.
These days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Making Home Affordable from the U.S. government has already helped many struggling homeowners. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist with Greg Priddy.
And Diane Lees.
And let's see what's in the news this week.
All right. This one's ugly. It began with a headline, "Only good cyclist is a dead one."
Ooh.
Oh, yes. So you remember our friend Carlton Reed. He's the editor of bikebiz.com in the UK.
Roads were not built for cars.
That is correct.
Okay.
On the other hand, it was a horrible way to start my Thursday this past week. So it seems like the editor of the magazine, the Richmond Magazine, Richard Nye, which is a luxury magazine, I mean, a high glossy, you know, hoity-toity magazine, distributes 40,000 copies in the Tony London suburbs of Richmond, Twickenham, and Barnes, decided to write an editorial about how surprised he was that he enjoyed watching Olympic cycling, as well as the relief he felt at lapsing back into his normal cyclist-hating ways after the Olympics were over. Well, the magazine also contained a half-page display ad for Moore's Cycles, which has three stores in the publication's wealthy distribution areas. So Moore's was none too happy, as you can well imagine, and immediately posted to their website, quote, "We are fuming and have complained, but to no response. We had no idea of content when we placed the advert. We will not be advertising in this magazine whilst Richard Nye remains editor." As all of this was taking place, an elderly cyclist was hit and killed in Walton, a few miles from Richmond. A 79-year-old was hit by a lorry.
Mm.
So Carlton Reed, who is the editor, as I said, of Bike Biz, believes that Richard Nye will say it was all in jest and that he must like, quote, "playing with fire," unquote. So when Carlton tried to contact Mr. Nye, he was told that he's had a lot of phone calls and a deluge of email, you think? It turns out that 21% of adults in Richmond cycle at least once a week. It's the highest rate of any London borough. Oops. Hmm. This should be an interesting ongoing story. What do you think?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Roanoke.com, as we come back to the U.S., has something in their online or even in their written paper, I guess, called Pick of the Day. And the headline was, "Cyclists Make the Parkway Unsafe." This was also on Thursday, so it's like it's going from bad to worse. Evidently, these editors pick a letter and publish it. This one was obnoxious, and I'm kind of wondering if it was meant as it was written. It starts out, "Bravo to the National Park Service for getting serious about a real problem. On August 28th, as I returned to Vinton from a shopping trip at Walmart, I was thrilled to see a park ranger at the intersection of the Blue Ridge Parkway and Mill Mountain Parkway keeping the cyclists under control. Cyclists are constantly using the parkway, and I can't tell you how infuriating it is to have to wait to pass them on such a curvy road, especially around 5 p.m. when I'm driving home from work. Numerous times I've simply had to gun my engine and hope there was no oncoming traffic as I sped around a lone cyclist. Once I came into a blind corner and had to swerve to avoid hitting a cyclist descending at only 40 miles per hour. It was all so sudden that I nearly threw my cell phone out of the window as I jerked the wheel. I have tried pulling my truck alongside cyclists and letting them know how unsafe their behavior is, but they always gesture emphatically for me to move along. Kudos to the Park Service for stopping these cyclists and explaining how they can make the parkway safe. Will Moore, Roanoke." So I'm trying to figure out, is this real or is this tongue in cheek or is this just a rant? I have no idea. Pretty bizarre, huh?
Yeah.
All
not
right. Sure what you got, that. Dude?
Well, there's a couple of things coming up in our area here, a little corner of the world, and we like to toot our own horn. Why should New York and Portland get all the
all the
glory?
Kudos. Yes.
Yeah. So coming up the weekend of September 15th and 16th are a pair of memorial rides for cyclists who were tragically, unfortunately, killed while cycling here in Cleveland. The first one is the ride for Sylvia Bingham. It starts at 12 noon in Edgewater Beach, and it will follow her route from Edgewater to her work destination.
Which is what she did every day.
Right, and right. It's going to make a stop for an unveiling of a plaque, a memorial plaque, at the spot where she was hit by the truck.
I remember, she was not a native Clevelander. She was here either working or studying, and I mean, it just It really shocked our community. Yeah.
So that will be a ride of silence. And once again, that's 12 noon on Saturday, September 15th.
Okay.
BikeCleveland.org has more details about that if you are interested. And then the following day, Sunday, September 16th, is the fifth annual Ride for Miles, which rolls out right here on the John Carroll University campus at 10 a.m. on Sunday morning. RideForMiles.org. And that is, of course, in the memory of Miles Coburn, who was a biology professor here at JCU.
Right.
And all the money raised goes to help endow an annual seminar series about the environment in cycling and other related topics. And this year,
we have Jeff Mapes.
We do. Jeff Mapes is coming to the Cleveland Museum of Natural History on Friday, September 14th at 7:30 p.m. And that is co-sponsored by the Ride for Miles and the Intercontinental Hotel Cleveland.
And I think we will be interviewing Jeff after his appearance here at John Carroll. He's giving a lecture here at John Carroll, and then he's going to come down to the studio.
Oh, great.
And Mr. Regal and I are going to sit and he's going to run the boards for me, and we're going to interview Jeff and get – he has a wonderful book that he's going to be – I don't know if this is part of a book signing or not, but the book is called Pedaling Revolution, How Cyclists Are Changing American Cities. He spent 3 years researching his New York Times reviewed book, and he's going to discuss how bicycling is changing the design and culture of cities from New York to Portland. So we'll try and pick his brain a little bit. And that's all happening here in Cleveland, which is very cool.
Yeah. And then a bit to our south.
Oh, here we go.
A guy that we always get a kick out of talking to.
Rodney.
Rodney Hendrickson down in London, Kentucky.
Yep.
They're putting on the counterpart to the Redbud ride. This is called the Thriller Ride. It's October 13th. You've got your choice of three different routes. The Metric Century Thriller, it's a hilly metric century, or the 44.5 mile Zombie, or just the 12.5 mile Halloweeny. There'll be prizes for cyclists with the best costumes. There'll be Halloween themed rest stops. You know, leave it to
Rodney.
Rodney. There'll be a lot of fun stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You can go to cvcc-ky.org. For more information, if you'd like to truck on down to London, Kentucky for the Thriller Ride. All right, let's move along here.
Okay. His name is Willie Weir. He tells great stories. He's a writer for Adventure Cyclists blog. He has written two books. He was a theater person, and you'll get it as soon as you hear him. So let's welcome him to the show. Willie, thanks for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So you're a story all by yourself. I've decided to land on some of the highlights of you and your life in cycling, beginning with the trip you took with your friend Thomas Schroeder in 1981. How old were you and where did you guys go?
I was 19 years old. I turned 20 years old on the trip, and the reason I remember that is that basically from Oregon coast to New York City. Along the way, somewhere in Wisconsin was my 20th birthday, and my buddy Thomas, under the guise of I was fixing a flat, and he went on to look for some place for us to stay. He found a little place where we could, you know, pitch our tent or whatever, and he came back and he had bought a packet of 20 ice cream sandwiches. and so because it was my birthday, I ate 11 and he ate 9. So
oh my goodness.
It was definitely a trip fueled by ice cream sandwiches and probably little packets of oatmeal. I had $400 that was the budget for the trip. I sold a 64 Pontiac Tempest that I had, my car then, and I had enough money to pay for 6 rolls of film. So that's what I had for 3 months.
Wow.
So I kept putting the camera up there and going, no, that's not good enough. That's not good. Right.
Very cool. What kind of camera? Do you remember?
Yes, I had a Canon AE-1 that my dad gave to me that I carried that bounced around in my bicycle and my front handlebar bag until it was physically taken from me in Albania.
Oh, my goodness. And we will get to – I think that is a story we're going to get to, yes?
Yeah. But I think so.
Well, that's a camera.
You know, for us, we bought Univega Gran Turismo bikes.
Nice.
Just before the trip, there was somebody told me I needed a bike with a triple crank.
That's
and
true.
I'm not sure I even knew what a triple crank was, but that's what we got. And we were going to train, and we didn't get around to doing that either. And so we ended up getting a ride with some friends, their motorhome, and they dropped us off on Seaside, Oregon on July 2nd, 1981. And we carry, you know, everybody told us, you know, when you do your cross country trip, you have to take your bicycle and put your rear tire in the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
So sometime you can put it in the front. And so that day, the tide was out. I mean, oh my God, it was out. This is like the lowest tide since the moon has been in the heavens. And we were very road savvy, so we didn't even think about taking the panniers off the bicycle. So we lugged our bikes out there with all the panniers. It would seem like about a mile and a half out to where the water was, and the waves came in and got us all wet. But it didn't matter because we were having an adventure, and it was fabulous. And then a day later, we just realized that, wow, we had no idea that your butt could hurt that much after just one day of cycling.
Let alone however many weeks. How many weeks did it take you to get across?
We did the trip basically in 2 months. Didn't take a whole lot of breaks. We averaged about 70, 75 miles a day. And we did the bike centennial route, which, or at least part of that, basically from the West Coast, and that's the, you know, Bike Centennial, which is now the Adventure Cycling Association.
Right.
And we followed their route until we got to Wyoming, and then Diversion went up north. Thomas was raised in Michigan, so we visited up there, and they went across through Michigan and took the ferry across from Wisconsin and then southern Ontario and then over to New York. Thomas had to get back because he was going to UC Davis, and I toured the New England states for 3 months.
Wow.
On my own.
You were brave.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the time, at 20, it didn't necessarily feel that brave. It felt very daunting to begin with. I mean, we didn't really know. It was that leaving off on an adventure that we weren't sure we could do. At least I'm not sure I felt that way. And I remember one of the first major passes we climbed was McKenzie Pass in Oregon. And I remember it was raining and it had snowed that night. It was July. It wasn't supposed to snow. We had cotton, like a cotton sweatshirt and whatever for the trip. We had to go buy rain gear. And I remember sitting and sleeping later in a tent just thinking, I'm not sure I can do this. And then cycling up McKenzie Pass, which they finally opened after the snow had melted a bit, and getting up there and across, and we took off from there. And then 30 years later, Thomas and I did a trip just last year, and we slept in that same campground, and it was amazing to be sleeping in a tent that 30 years ago that I was an intrepid, very non-intrepid traveler, very scared and wondering what was going on, and realizing the next morning I was going to get up with my best buddy and climb this pass that we had climbed 30 years ago. And
wow.
that was incredible.
That's an awesome story. That's an awesome story. So you actually didn't start out your life as a cyclist. You started out as a theater person. And by the way you tell stories is very theatrical anyway. So you never left theater in my non-humble opinion.
What's funny is that I didn't, you know, I've just kind of stumbled my way along because I didn't mean to be in theater either. I was a biology major. I was a biology major.
Okay.
In college, and I wasn't doing very well, and I wasn't sure I was going to be able to graduate. And so I switched to a major where I didn't have to write term papers because I hated writing and I decided, well, theater, they won't make me write any papers, and went from there. And by the time I graduated, I auditioned for some shows, and wow, they let me perform on stage.
Well,
cool.
What's really funny is for somebody who didn't like writing, you've written 2 books and you write regularly, like only all the time.
Oh, my family would just—they still laugh about that.
Yeah,
I ever got paid to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I learned, because I had a lot of teachers that said that, you know, writing was grammar and this and that, and so from early on, I felt that I couldn't write, and it wasn't until, and the way I ended up starting writing was that in theater, you're always looking for a monologue. I mean, that's how you get work. It's your resume. You get up there and you do your 3-minute piece of classical, your comedy piece, and you gotta grab people's attention right off the bat. And when I started writing and first journaling, and then when I started writing for public radio, even though I didn't know that they were gonna carry it, I didn't think to myself, I'm writing a piece, I thought, well, I know monologues. I know 3 minutes. Why don't I do that?
And what's interesting is the pieces you write for the Adventure Cycling blog are like little monologues. They're just wonderful little vignettes of whatever's going on in your head at the moment. And we'll get to that. But I'd like to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Willie Weir. He's up in Seattle and he's telling us stories and they're really good. I want to talk about another story, which I heard the story a long time ago, and you mentioned it in sort of our back and forth conversations getting ready for the show. You've traveled all over the world, and one of my favorite stories about you is the trip you took with your then girlfriend, who is now your wife. And mm-hmm. Do you want to tell that story? Because it's pretty funny.
Right. Yeah, it only took me about 3 hours, but I'll give you the short version is, I'd always been a solo. I did that trip with Thomas, and then every trip after that was on my own. And I did a 5-month trip every year for 7 years. I was a solo traveler after I'd done that first trip with my buddy Thomas. And I met this woman at the Aurora Highland Ice Skating Arena, and it was kind of one of those, you know, love at first sight kind of situations. But I already had another trip planned, and so 4 months later, I was saying goodbye to this person, and it was really the first trip I'd ever gone on that I didn't want to go. And you know, you shouldn't fall in love if you're an adventure traveler kind of thing, especially solo. And so we were going to meet at the Apartheon 5 months later. Kat, she rode a bicycle, but she was a bicycle traveler. And I was already scheduled to write stuff for both public radio and for another publication. And I was heading to the Balkans. I didn't even know whether I was going to be able to get into Bosnia, because this is, and when I finally did, the only vehicles on the road were I-4 troops and tanks.
Nice.
But I started on that trip, and I was completely depressed. And she ended up calling after I'd been traveling a while, and she said, I'd really like to know what it'd be like to be there with you. And I said, are you really serious? And she said, yes. I said, well, why don't you think about it for a while, and I'll get back to you, and we'll see that. And I hung up the phone, and I just thought, oh, you moron. I mean, this beautiful woman that you've fallen in love with just offered to quit her job and come travel with you, and you told her to think about it, and she's going to think about it for like 20 seconds and dump the bicycle dude. And so I ended up, I'm really frugal. And at this point, I did not have a lot of money, and it's really, really expensive to call. And so I ended up, I was in Croatia. No, I was in Slovenia, and I crossed the border into Italy because phone calls were a lot less expensive then. And I called up, and I got her voice message machine instead of her, and I hadn't even thought that I was going to message machine. And so I blathered out, like, hi, this is Willie, remember me, ha, oh, man. And it just blathered on, and I hung up the phone after that message, and I thought, well, I've sealed the deal. She is never, ever going to even think about coming on this journey with me. I called her a couple of days later. I had to go back across the border, and the guys at the border said, what are you doing in Italy? And I said, I'm going to make a phone call. Okay, sure. So I called her up, and she said yes. And what's amazing is that she had never been on a bike trip before. And the first time that she ever traveled with panniers on a bicycle was from the airport in Budapest into downtown Budapest. And I always tell people that because often people think, well, I need to train, I need to learn languages, I need to do whatever. But really the first question you have to answer is whether or not you want to have an adventure. And if you answer that question, then everything else will fall into place. You'll get it done. And so here we were, and when we ended up in Budapest, I asked her to marry me. Now that was not maybe the wisest thing for me to do, because I had no idea what her answer was going to be. And she's going to come on this bicycle trip. What if she'd said no? You know, no. And then, okay, now let's go on a bike trip together.
Right.
Fortunately, she said yes, and we took off from there. And it was trial by fire. I mean, 4 months together, and there was sickness, and there was mountain passes, and there were magical events. Being literally adopted by a grandma and grandpa Buna in this little tiny village in Romania, but then also being beaten and robbed in Albania. And,
yeah, that's what I remembered.
Yeah. And you know, even that experience that we had, we remember, you know, because one of the things about it was that for me, I'd been on the road a lot, but this was her first trip.
Right.
And having the situation that had happened, and we had to sit down and just tell stories to each other about how amazing the trip had been, to kind of get over that experience and also realizing that we didn't want to not continue on. And that we came back from a 4-month trip 10 years into our relationship, in a sense, you know, the stuff that we've been through.
Sure.
It was incredible. And we just finished our 7th trip together, and we're about ready to take off for another one.
Well, of all the countries you've traveled, now, do you still only travel with Kat, or do you travel alone still?
No, Kat. She's been on every trip since. She doesn't like to get left behind.
No, I don't blame her.
I think we're both that way.
Yeah.
So we've traveled. In one trip, Cuba, I went a little bit early, and then Kat joined me later. We had a bicycle that I had a single bike called an 8-ball that I could take apart and put the middle part in. It became a tandem.
Cool.
And so then we rode tandem around Cuba for 3 months.
Right.
But most of the time it's been us together, which has worked really well. I think that combination for me as a solo traveler, the great thing is when I travel with Kat, I get to see the feminine side of the world, in that there's a lot of places in the world where men and women are separate. And when you travel as a couple, you kind of get the chance to see both sides. And of course, the same goes for her. And it's also made me appreciate cities, which I always wanted to get out of as a cyclist when I first started traveling. And I think Kat was the person that made me really enjoy exploring a city on a bicycle, which, of course, we've done now a lot because we live in Seattle, and we became part of the Washington State Vehicle Redistribution Program about 7 years ago.
Oh, yeah?
Which is that, yeah, we had our car stolen. And we didn't replace it.
And so they never found
actually,
it.
What? Sorry, Ed?
They never found it.
By the time we had decided that we were going to go without a car, they did find it 6 weeks later, but it immediately fell apart, and so we just decided not to replace it. And Kat, for the first week, actually accused me of being involved in the crime. Because
really?
I had talked about wanting to go car-free for a while, and so finally she realized that, no, I hadn't arranged to have our car stolen. And it's been great.
You know, you mentioned something which I forgot until you just said that, and that is Seattle, which a lot of people think is this super bike-friendly place, isn't all that.
Yeah, I really wish it was. I mean, Seattle is a city that is filled with cyclists. But if you go around the world and you see, you know, what a safe bicycle city is, almost every city in America is not. I mean, Portland, I think, has probably done the best job of any city in the country that I've seen. But, you know, we have a real hard downtown area, Tilly, and the city hasn't found out a safe way for people to get down through in our downtown. And for me, if you're truly a bicycle-friendly city, you should be able to have, you know, a 10-year-old ride their bicycle downtown, and I wouldn't necessarily have them do that. And I was a courier in downtown Seattle, so I'm used to that. But I wouldn't let my grandmother ride, you know, down there. And,
wow.
And there are a lot of places. One of the things, and one of the ways we got to know Portland, is I pitched a story for the magazine for Adventure Cyclists. I said, look, we're going to do a bicycle trip, but we're not going to go to country. We're going to go to Portland. And my editor was like, what? I said, we're going to go and we're going to take our tent and our stove and our sleeping bag, and we're going to basically pack a little like we were going to India or to, you know, to Europe, and we're going to cycle. And we ended up spending 10 days cycling in within the city limits of Portland, and no friends, no hotels as far as, you know, just lodging. And we ended up spending one night in a tent in a campground, and every other night we were in somebody's home or in somebody's backyard with our tent that we'd met along the way.
Cool.
And we cycled 250, 300 miles within the city. And I could tell you that a 6-year-old could have been with us the whole time, and I would have felt perfectly, perfectly safe.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
It really is. They've come a long way.
So this just kind of blew me away, but you hold a world record for marathon table tennis. What the hell is that?
Yeah, oh well, you know, when I was in third grade, and I was a pudgy little primary school student, we used to have the Penguin Book Club, and I got a copy of the Guinness Book of World Records. I remember telling my friends that I was going to be in there someday, and of course I had no idea why, and they all laughed at me. But my buddy Thomas and I, same guy, that we bicycled across the country together, we decided to break a world record in 76, and we ended up playing for 103.5 hours, which it's more about sleep deprivation than
taking. Yeah, I guess.
And we broke the record in then, like 4 days before they published the Guinness Book of World Records. Some guys in England broke our record. And so we didn't get in the book. And so 2 years later, I ended up teaming up with three brothers, Mark, Lance, and Phil. And the four of us, played for 101 hours, 1 minute, 11 seconds. And that record has held since.
Wow.
So it's still, I think, still in there somewhere.
Can you really sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game backwards, too?
Now, see, that comes from being a Seattle Mariner fan in the 80s.
I guess.
The Mariners were pretty bad.
Yeah.
And we'd be out there, a bunch of actors, whatever, out in the middle, out in center field bleachers. And the Mariners would be behind by 11 runs by the fourth inning. And so what do? You do stuff like learn that. So it's game, ball, get out your... Strikes 3-2 when it's 4. Shame it's window, the if team home, the 4. Root, it's 4 back at ever. I if can, oh, I jacker. Crack and nuts, piece of me by. Crowd the with, out. Me take game ball, the 2 out. Me take.
Very nice. Very nice. If we had an audience, we would be applauding loudly and whistling. That is awesome. Awesome. We live in Cleveland, so, you know, our baseball seasons are pretty up and down, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when you know you're a fan.
True.
When
true
you
that.
Still go and you still care when, you know, your season's over by about July.
Yeah.
As far as any winning potential of playoffs and
yeah.
World Series. Yeah.
We have a beautiful park, though. Jacobs.
Yeah.
Well, it was Jacobs Field. Now it's Progressive Field. Sorry. I didn't want to screw that up. We're going
right,
to run out of time,
that.
Unfortunately, tonight. And I, you know what? We could talk for hours. I could see that. Are you going to Interbike?
I am going to be at Interbike, yes.
So maybe we'll hook up and talk again. And
okay.
But I want to reserve the right to bring you back onto the show and tell some more stories. Would that be okay with you?
Oh, please do.
All right.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
Oh, and I really had fun. And thank you for singing.
my pleasure.
All right. We'll talk again.
Okay.
Thanks, Willie.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Willie Weir joined us from Seattle, Washington.
Where he's growing vegetables, I guess.
Growing vegetables. Not as cycle friendly as we would be led to believe, perhaps.
Yeah.
That's interesting insight there.
Yeah. That is interesting. You always think of Seattle as being, well, probably not as bike friendly as Portland. That's true.
What's the Outspoken Cyclist travel budget like? Maybe I could do a...
A comparison?
A compare and contrast Cleveland, Seattle, Portland.
It's about $1.380. You think you can do it on that?
Can't do it on that.
No. I know.
But I might like to do that anyway. I'll give you a full detailed comparison of the...
If we had a travel budget, wouldn't we have fun? Remember, this is all volunteer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we had a travel budget, we might never put a show on there.
That's true, too. True that.
Okay, we got to wrap this up.
Okay.
Don't forget the Sylvia Bingham ride next Saturday and Ride for Miles next Sunday and the symposium at the Natural History Museum here in Cleveland on Friday night the 14th. All good things to check out if you are in town in the Cleveland area next weekend.
Okay, then.
And as always, ride safe. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.